I am Bob Earl. I am a drug addict and alcoholic. I guess if we're going to be a heretic, we might as well be one on Sunday morning. Good a day as any. God, I didn't get to hear much of Bob's talk. I got here late. The plane was late. I don't care anymore when planes are late. I've tried to reduce my life today to the simple realities. And the reality is that it's necessary that the plane arrive. I don't care when. That's ceased to be important. You know, the control issues are sort of falling away now. So they brought me here. They said, well, you want to stop at the hotel and get a nap? I said, oh, no, I'll go right to the meeting. It'll be fine. I have no idea what you said. I went to sleep. I did hear you say something. I'll get the tape. I heard you say something about running, though, right? You run? All right. Now we'll get to the rest of you suckers sitting here this morning who failed to get up at 5 and put in a few miles. What? Something bother someone? Listen, I'm just starved. You think you're uncomfortable now? Wait. I had no delusions that if people were gonna, you know, be thrilled when I got done this morning. I don't go anymore with that attitude. Oh, they'll really like me in Boise, you know. I think, I wonder how much meat they eat in Boise, you know. Ask my poor host who had to go out and have a vegetarian dinner last night. I got to hear Keith and Sue last night, though. Whoa, all right. You know, I'd love to hear honesty, man. I'd love to hear honesty and truth. It moves me deeply. Anything less bores the shit out of me. Drives me crazy. So I get bored at most conventions. With most convention speakers. Because I'm tired of being entertained. And the reason I'm tired of being entertained is because most people don't make it past 5 years. And every now and then people call me up and they'll say, even your committee had to say, well, we really want you to come talk, but we'd appreciate if you talk a little more about AA. I'd be happy to. I'd be thrilled and delighted. See, I get real concerned, man, because most people aren't making it, and I think we got to look at why. And I think if we don't look at why, we're fooling ourselves. And I think it's time to stop fooling ourselves. You heard Alan on the speaker this morning. You heard Keith and Sue last night, man. That was one of the finest descriptions of the alcoholic home I've ever heard in my life. Put it right out there for you to look at. And if anybody can walk out of this room and think that we're supposed to ignore that, those of us who were raised in that kind of an environment are supposed to pretend it didn't exist. I don't know what you're thinking about, man. You know, I do not know what you're thinking about. You know, these issues are killers in recovery. In recovery. Screw when you're drinking and using, it's not an issue. The fact that I was raised by an alcoholic father and the, you know, doormat Al-Anon mother, you know, had no reality on what I was doing when I was drinking alcohol and using narcotics. That was the problem. That was the primary problem and answer in my life. It kept me sane. It helped me to continue to stuff my feelings down so I didn't have to feel anything, because I don't want to feel anything ever, because you can't feel things and look good. You can't feel things and be in control. You know, I don't have any admiration for cool, calm, pipe-smoking people. I figure someday they're going to climb up on a building with a machine gun and kill 30 goddamn people. Doesn't move me at all. Not at all. I like people who look stupid. Crying when everyone else is laughing. Laughing when everybody else is crying. Because whatever they are, they're in touch with their own feelings, as inappropriate as they might be to the situation at that moment. And our feelings can be extremely inappropriate to a situation. My neighbor's car doesn't start, he calls the auto club. My car doesn't start, I call suicide prevention. we have a different perspective on what has just transpired in each life, you know? He has a minor mechanical problem. My life is over. I had this whole day planned, and it's sitting in front of the house, and it's not moving. You know, I'm done. Okay? So I drank and used drugs, and I had no time to talk about any of it because it was so goddamn long ago, it bores me to tears, my own past. You know? I mean, I hear a lot about physical sobriety. I heard Keith talk about it. Man, I support that. Someday physical sobriety is all you're going to have. All you're going to have. Physical sobriety is critical. It is the foundation. Somebody said, how do you view your life today, Bob? I say, well, people talk about this stuff like looking in the mirror. I love that because that one's been a, whoa, tough long haul for me. And it's kind of like if somebody said, well, sum it all up. I have to say when I was born, I was like a picture puzzle. A perfect picture puzzle. All put together. Whole and complete. And in a very short period of time, about the time I started to walk, because alcoholic parents can't handle children that walk. You know, the minute you begin to have an identity of your own, you're trouble. You're something they had not counted on. So now the puzzle is thrown on the floor and shattered into 1,000 pieces. And this is a long time ago. It's got nothing to do with alcohol, drugs, or anything else. Long before I discovered any of it, the puzzle was scattered all over. I figure it's like, you know, eventually I get through my drug addiction, my alcoholism, I come to AA. And AA for me is like the table on which I've started to put this puzzle back together. Without this table, I got no place to put my puzzle. I've got no place to put this puzzle back together. It's it. It's right here. And I'm bringing the pieces in and I'm putting them in. But I have to go a lot of places and get a lot of pieces, see, to put this puzzle together so that when I look in the mirror now that there's a person there instead of, you know, this Picasso painting, you know, sort of distorted and not quite a whole face looking back at me out of the mirror, you know. So I've had to go to therapy 17 years sober because I wanted to die. You know, I had to get help, man. I had to get another tool. I discovered that what I eat's got a lot to do with what my emotions do to me. So I had to change all that, another tool. I found out that my drug of choice in recovery is anxiety. You know, most people I know, that's it. They love it. Love it. Can't get high, get crazy. You know, worry. Just get it going. You know, I know people years sober. Walking around still, anxiety, still their drug of choice, 25 years in recovery, you know. Success, do here, do this, get that, right? I find with extraneous physical exercise, I burn off the energy that I use to create anxiety. I'll be sitting around the house, and the psychotic part of me will want to get anxious. They'll say, oh, hey, let's get it going here. We got a lot of trouble going on. You know, our life is really disastrous. But I can't, you know, I've just come back from the gym. I can't get up the energy to work with it. You know, oh, fuck it. You know, I can't. You know. So I've had to go get all these tools and bring them to bear in my recovery so I can put this puzzle together. You know, so the table, I gotta have the table. I gotta have AA. That's the foundation. But once I ceased to drink the alcohol, to me, initial recovery, initially, the first, however long it takes, is only about avoiding the substance. I mean, I don't know what you did when you first came in here, but all I wanted to do was not go back to where I came from. I didn't even want to be here. Didn't like AA, didn't like the people, I didn't like anything about it, but I didn't want to go back. That was the only yardstick I had. So my initial recovery was about avoiding the substance. The substance was everywhere I went. It was in my mind when I woke up, when I dreamed, when I slept, everywhere. It was like, you know, it was like the substance. You got to stay away from the substance. Well, you stay, you go to meetings, you talk to people, you get a sponsor, you begin to work your steps. And boy, one day you look around, you know, and suddenly the substance isn't all that important anymore. You realize you just went through a whole day and you didn't think about drinking or using. You go, oh, my God, what do you know? You go comfortable for a little while. Huh? If you're comfortable this morning, I'm here to take care of that. I heard an Al-Anon speaker one time. I had the greatest line I ever heard. She said her sponsor told her now that she was in recovery, her responsibility was to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. So, get a little comfortable, go to a movie, start to wander around the hallowed halls of the AA, and then something begins to happen in recovery to me. I started to get crazier. I didn't get better. I got crazier. In 11 years of drug addiction and alcoholism, I never contemplated killing myself. I never thought of taking my life when I was out there drinking and using. I had to get sober and come to AA before suicide became a real thing. And then it became a daily solution. I'd wake up in the morning and say, well, you can go to a meeting or kill yourself. Well, let me think about it, you know? Killing myself has got a lot of appeal right now, you know? But you go to the meeting. You go and you drive by the concrete abutment that you picked out on the freeway, you know, to do it on. That's the one I'm going to do it on. If I can just hit it hard enough. I always figured in my luck I'd live, you know. That's the only thing that kept me from jumping off a building. I figured I'd goddamn live. They'd be wheeling me into meetings, you know, drooling down my chest. And then we come into AA and people say to us, surrender to God. Turn your will and your life over to God, a loving father. My father was an alcoholic. I have no conception of a loving father. You tell me surrender my life to God, and I see myself 20 years sober, working in a men's recovery house, celibate, washing dishes, talking about gratitude. You know, and that's what I have coming. See? So you say surrender to God, a loving parent? I don't know anything about it. I have no conception of what that is. I heard a priest at an ACA convention in San Diego a few weeks ago. The greatest line I ever heard. He said, all of us who were raised by dysfunctional parents were raised in a household whose very foundation and fabric was lies. It was all lies. And these lies were called love. And then we sit around these meetings and wonder why we don't know how to love somebody and we don't know how to let somebody love us. Because we don't know how. See? My only problem, once I was free from the substance and had worked the 12 steps with information, I don't have much. And what I got's no good. No good. So I kept coming to meetings, kept putting up my hand. I'm an alcoholic, sponsored 150 people, drove 40,000 miles a year to institutions, spoke whatever I asked, you know, recognized one of the young people, you know. I got sober almost 25 years ago. Man, I was one of the, you know, one of the babies. Went everywhere. They'd like to see us. They didn't believe we could stay clean and sober. They told us, I heard an old-timer one time say at North Hollywood Clubhouse, you guys got sober here, you know, 25, 26 years old. I feel sorry for you. You'll never make it. He said, you're going to live too long to stay sober. He was serious. He was serious. Respected member of the program. He was serious. It's a tragedy. You know what he was talking from? How hard it was for him. How hard it was for him. Man, I wasn't put here for it to be hard. I was born happy, joyous, and free. That's how I was born. Look at children. Children are wonderful. Little children. Happy, joyous, and free. And man, that was destroyed by the original dynamic duo. Okay? I had no identity, no personality, no sense of anything. Just for your information, the thing about being silent and a look will do it. That ain't brand new. That didn't originate with us. That didn't even originate in this country. There's a wonderful woman who writes books about stuff that'll make you so goddamn uncomfortable you want to die on your coffee table. But when you're ready, you might buy one and read it. One's called For Your Own Good. And the other is the drama, The Gifted Child, and the author's name is a woman by Alice Miller, and she's a psychiatrist in Germany, and she's brilliant. Brilliant. And she talks about how most child rearing is no more than abuse. And she talks about how it began over 500 years ago. And she quotes a book on raising children that was written 350 years ago. And this book says, now that you have your child home, here you must begin to teach the child the necessary lessons to aid this child in life. Now, if the child begins to cry at night, you need to go in and check first and make sure that their Pampers are dry and that they don't have any gastric problems. Once establishing that they do not have a physical need, you're to let this infant know that the crying is not acceptable. At first, you do it simply with your voice. And if that fails to be enough, to stop the infant from crying, eventually you must resort to loud noises, clapping your hands. If the loud noises eventually are not enough to stop this problem, then you may have to strike the child. But if you're persistent in this line of child rearing, eventually, when the child is older, a simple look will be enough. And we're supposed to ignore this stuff? We're supposed to pretend this stuff didn't happen? Man, I worked a good AA program. I worked a great AA program. I don't know a living human being in Alcoholics Anonymous worked a better AA program than me, and I lived in Laguna with Chuck, and I don't throw him in. You know? Nobody. I don't know anybody. Yet when I was 5 years sober, I wanted to die more than anything else in the world because I'd hit that wall. Because what was happening? I hadn't had any drugs and alcohol in 5 years. Guess what? Feelings were coming back. And I didn't know what to do with them. Try and take them to a meeting and I'd be accused of self-pity. Hey, screw you! I can't make that distinction. I have my brains beaten out. I have a right to cry about that. You know? It's sad. It's tragic. And if I don't feel that, I don't experience that, I don't think I count. I don't think who I am or what I am or what I'm about has any meaning. But I stuffed it down. I had 5 years. I surrendered to God. I said, God, if you're not there, I'm going to die. I didn't care. Loving parents, screw it. It didn't matter. You know, my father, whatever you are, take it all. I'm it. I give up. I'm yours. And he took it all. Broke my back the next day. And turned my life around. I mean, it required that. Throughout recovery, for 24 and a half years, whatever happens that looks bad is always wonderful. Always wonderful. I know you don't want to hear that, particularly if you're right in the muck right now. It doesn't look too thrilling. You know, you can't see from the sewage, you know. It's tough. Trust me. It always works out. God gave me everything. He poured everything into my life. Man, I became a writer. Christ, I didn't have anything. I was a hood, you know. I had no education. I had no profession, no trade, no zippo, man. I'd been working in a car wash and I became a diecaster, broke my goddamn back, and I'm a writer. I'm a writer, you know. Can't spell. Failed English ever since the fourth grade. I tuned typing because all the girls took typing. They took me to my high school, you know, and showed me the typing class. The best looking girls in the school were in the typing class. And there was not one guy in the goddamn class. I said, this is, you know. I mean, I was totally insane. I knew nobody was going to give me a shit over being in typing. I took the class, you know. I said, I got to be here, you know, this is it. So I know how to type. It's wonderful, you know. Modern science or whatever the hell it is now, I have word process. I don't even have to spell now. They spell, you know, it's great. I just borrowed one from a friend that beeps every time you misspell. I mean, you know, you can't, it won't even let you, kind of like, I guess, having an element around. You know, you just can't. So God poured everything into my life. He lived up to absolutely every promise that I've ever heard made by, you know, midnight ministers on TV or people in AA meetings or, you know, convention speakers or whoever I ever heard. He gave it all to me. He gave it all to me. He dumped everything into my life. He dumped a career and success and some notoriety and money and all of it. All of it. Put it all on my life. But I still only had the table and a couple of pieces of the puzzle. That's all I had. The rest of them were missing. So I had to do what most of us have to do when we don't have the tools. I had to destroy it all in recovery. I had to wipe it all out in recovery. Okay? And this is sponsoring 100 guys, going to 7 meetings a week, writing 32 goddamn inventories, you know, speaking all over the goddamn planet, you know. I had created a personality. I had recreated what most of us do, or at least I did, out of necessity. The odds are, if you were raised in an alcoholic household, and you are a practicing alcoholic or drug addict, and you come to these recovery programs, once you've stopped fighting off the substance, you will then create a personality. But it has nothing to do with who you are. You will piece this person together off of people that you meet in for program. You'll get a little of this sponsor, and a little of this speaker, and a little of this guy, and you'll build a person. Okay? Because if you're like I am, I had a secret, man. I had a deep, deep secret, and I wasn't sharing this secret with anybody, and that secret is that way down deep inside of me, the truth is something's wrong with me. And in any situation, anywhere, under any circumstances, I am not enough. It doesn't matter if I'm speaking at a Skid Row meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous or if I'm at a high-level executive meeting at a motion picture studio. I'm not enough. I know it going in the door, man, and I'm not going to let you know that. Because you get killed for letting that information out in an alcoholic household. We're talking killed, beat, senseless. So you just keep quiet. So I kept quiet here, like I kept quiet every place else. And in a lot of cases, in a lot of meetings, being good is encouraged. Being a good, quiet child is encouraged. You know? That's okay. So I learned one thing essential to having a recovery personality. And that is that they're always fine. Good AAs are always fine. I learned that by talking to people at meetings. You walk up to Bill before the meeting and say, "Hi, Bill, how are you?" Bill says, "I'm fine, thanks, Bob. How about yourself?" "Not bad, thanks." Bill walks off and George runs up and says, "Did you hear what happened to Bill?" "No, what happened to Bill?" "Oh, Christ, his wife divorced him, his kid got hit by a car, he lost his job, and they repossessed his car." I thought, okay, I get the message. No matter what happens, you're fine. So I kept going to meetings, "I'm fine. I'm Bobby E., I'm okay. A little nuts, perhaps. I hear a lot of voices, but nobody's talking about them, so I won't." "Everybody at the meeting's okay, fuck, I'm okay, hey, I'm all right. Good to see you guys." People walk up to me and say, "Hi, Bob," about 5 years sober, "Hi, Bob, how are you?" Reality would have been, the honest thing would have been if I dropped to my knees, grabbed the person around the ankles, and started to sob on top of their shoes, you know. You know, couldn't do that, because I don't count. What I feel doesn't matter. People said to me, "What's important to you today, Bob?" I say, two things are important to me, to be in touch with myself as a human being and to be in touch with myself as a child of God. And I somehow got the idea that those two things aren't compatible, because as a human being, I've got a lot of feelings. And they come up at inopportune times. I can be walking through my house for no reason at all and just get really sad. Nothing has happened. And I'm sad. I'm talking sad. Screw tears of joy. We're talking, you know. But I don't allow myself that. My mind will say to me immediately, "What are you sad about?" "I don't know what I'm sad about, but I feel awful." And you sure don't work much of a program, man, if you're, you know, "Oh, okay. All right. I'll fix it, you know, I'll do a better program." Or conversely, what's even worse is you'll be sitting around the house and suddenly feel good. Nothing will have happened, no one will have called, no check will have come in the mail, nothing will have transpired, you just suddenly feel good. No reason at all, you feel good. And if you're blessed with my mind, it says to you, "How come you feel so good?" "Oh, God, I don't know. I just feel good." Well, if you were in touch with the reality of your life, you wouldn't feel good. Anyway. If you're like I am, you're going to fight one battle in recovery. One battle. You. That's it. That's it. And you know, the killer was when I was fighting the battle of me and thought I was responsible for how I was dying. I ain't responsible, guys. Sorry, I'm not responsible. My parents get the credit. They get it all. They get all the responsibility for the fact that I don't know how to have a meaningful relationship. I don't know how to hold a goddamn job. I don't know how to communicate with another human being. That I'm terrified by the expression on a man's face. That all a boss has got to do is look at me out of the corner of his eye and I want to die. And maybe he's just got gas. I mean, I don't know. You know, it doesn't have necessarily anything to do with me, but it doesn't stop me from dying. It doesn't stop me from dying. I didn't do any of that stuff. That's not my responsibility. Now, they're not to blame either. Be real careful here. There's a big thing between blame and responsibility. I love what John Bradshaw said. Everybody's responsible, nobody's to blame. You know, because all I got to do is look at what was done to my poor parents. I mean, they didn't sit down one day over a table and say, well, let's see what we can do to destroy this guy. You know, I bet we can turn him into a gun-carrying lunatic and just put him out there on the streets, you know? Now, how should we go about that? There must be books, you know? They just did to me what was done to them. That's all. But I gotta pay attention to that stuff. Once I get through my stuff, then I gotta get to that stuff. And recovery for me is all of it. You know, and when anybody sits in a meeting, you know, I hear people, they go up to their sponsor, and I used to do this to my babies, and I'd like to goddamn beat my head in for it. Babies of mine come to me and say, I can't do this anymore, man. I need more help. This is killing me. I've gotta go see a therapist. I gotta get help. I'd say, well, you know, then go get another sponsor. Because obviously AA and I aren't enough. That's right! So what? What am I supposed to do? Tie myself to a moving train? You know? I mean, everything I've read in the book says, hey, go for it. Get any tool you gotta have. You know? I mean, where do we lose... My biggest argument is, where do we get off the track here? Bill never stopped seeking. He never quit looking for stuff, you know. He'd be in an ACA meeting today. He's an adult child, you know. For Christ's sakes, Bill and Dr. Bob used to hold seances in Dr. Bob's house. You know, these are our founders, guys. You know, we don't know how much of our program came from the other side. You know? And then we get real serious and uptight.
Oh, hey. Don't say anything about that in the book. Be grateful for being sober, son.
I am, but I still want to blow my brains out. You see? So I had to go get another tool. I used to fire babies. When I had to go to therapy 17 years sober, I didn't want to go. But I had to go. Because I had everything I ever wanted in my life. I had a gorgeous girlfriend, penthouse apartment, expensive car, lucrative, incredible contract at the studios. 17 years sober, recognized junior AA guru. And wanted to die in the worst possible way. I wanted to die. Somebody said, I think it's time you got help. And I went to get help. And I had to learn some unpleasant things. I went to see this lady at our first encounter, our get acquainted meeting. She said, tell me a little bit about yourself. Start with your childhood and tell me a little bit about yourself. I said, well, when I was 15 years old, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School. I discovered the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol. For the next 11 years, I ran the streets, drank alcohol, used narcotics, and brought a lot of it into the country under unfriendly circumstances. I said, 17 years ago, I found the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and I've been clean and sober ever since. She said, wait a minute, I didn't say, you know, you're... I said, start with your childhood. You weren't born when you were 15. I said, well, I don't remember anything. She got this great smile on her face. See, and I thought, I was such a self-serving little bastard, I thought the smile meant, uh-huh. When I didn't get done writing the paper on this sucker, I'll be published and get the notoriety I deserve. You know. I had no idea what the smile meant when she was just smiling, and the smile simply said this, if you're willing to stick it out, I'm going to introduce you to somebody you never met. You. And I'm going to be here when that happens. And then I'm going to introduce you to somebody you forgot you think died. And that's a little boy. A little tiny boy who lives inside of you. And his pain and suffering is so great. He's been in hiding for a long time. Well, I thought, you know, typical, I was a good AA. I thought, what has that crap got to do with anything? You know, I've written 32 responsible inventories. With lines, without lines, with columns, without columns. They all began at 15. Nobody ever said a word to me. Not a word. You know why? Because out of the 6 sponsors I read them to, none of them could remember back past 15 either. They didn't think there was anything unusual about it. They couldn't recall the pain of their own childhood either. So we ignore it. And then somewhere between 5 and 8 years, most people leave. Most people go away. The pain gets too great. And they go back to the solution that they know works. God, you know, well, the pain got great because I was short on information. My problem is lack of information. And the book tells me, man, anybody that closes their mind is in serious trouble. And then we sit in these hollow little halls and close our minds.
Oh, don't talk about that program in here. That's not allowed. You know. Somebody should have told that to Bill when he was off dropping acid. You know.
Don't talk about that. Don't talk about it. If there's anything in the world I need in recovery for me, once I'm no longer battling the substance, once I've done the initial best job I can do with the 12 steps of this program, it's information. Because I don't know how to take care of myself. I don't know anything about taking care of myself. I don't know how to love myself. I don't know how to stand up for myself. I don't know how to draw limitations. I don't know how to have relationships. All my relationships were absolute goddamn disasters. Every one of them, I've been married 5 times in sobriety, for Christ's sakes. You know. I didn't keep trying. It's just, you know, I didn't know. I wasn't in touch with my feelings. How the hell can you have a relationship with somebody not in touch with their feelings? Yeah, you know, this is getting great now. You know, there's women in Southern California have started a meeting for women who are in relationships with men who aren't in touch with their feelings. I think an outstanding question to open with is, why are you in the relationship? But we won't bother with that, you know. We'll skip past that one for a minute. You want to know why we're not in touch with our relationships? How about when we walk in the house 3 years old and we fell off our tricycle and tore all the skin off our knees and it's bleeding and we walk off to our dad who's sitting in the chair sucking up his beer and we cry our eyes out and we say it hurts and the dad says, stop crying. He says, I can't stop crying, it hurts too bad. The father says, if you don't stop crying, man, I'm going to give you something to cry about. And you cry on because you can't stop crying. And then he unloads on you. When you finally get up out of the corner, your nose is bleeding, you know, one of your teeth is gone. You got the message. Showing feelings is not a good idea. So you don't. I learned my lesson well. I never cried after that point. I was 18 years of age. I laid in Georgia Street Emergency Hospital in downtown Los Angeles with 2 bullets in me belonging to the Los Angeles Police Department. When the surgeon came up to the table, I told him to take his anesthesia and stick it in his ass. My father would have been proud. I unfortunately fainted about 7 seconds later. But I had a fleeting moment there, you know, that looks good. That knife went in, I went out. You know, that's the last thing I remember. Because he was more than willing to oblige me. I was not on the, you know, treat him nice list. And I can't laugh. I can't laugh. You can't laugh in an alcoholic household. You cannot get in a giggling fit if you're a child in a household with alcoholics because you are living with paranoids and they know who you're laughing at. I don't know how to laugh. I've had to learn how to laugh. in recovery. People who used to laugh, really laugh, not just that, you know,
no breathing sort of, you know.
Used to embarrass me. If I was out publicly with somebody who laughed, they would embarrass me. Because they were drawing attention to themselves. I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand to be around people who asked questions. Go out to a new restaurant. You know, my worst first experience in a sushi bar was one of the worst experiences of my life. Because I went with a friend of mine who doesn't have any of these problems. So when he doesn't understand something, he just asks somebody. It wouldn't even enter his mind not to. He would think that if you didn't ask, something was wrong with you. So now my role in this was to go down and sit at the end of this little sushi bar on an angle where I could watch the other people so I could behave like they behave. My whole life has been spent watching you so I could behave like you behave. That didn't change when I came into AA. I watched you so I could behave like you behave. It didn't have anything to do with who I was. This dumb son of a bitch started at one end of the sushi bar and walked all the way to the other end, taking the sushi chef with him, asking him what each fish was. What it was, where it came from, what's it taste like, would he like it as a first-time person in a sushi bar? I thought, oh, God. Please, don't. Spare me. I only don't ask questions because I don't know how to ask questions. I think you got to ask a question, there's something wrong with you. Because if I ever asked a question at home, nobody had an answer. So they don't have the answer because they didn't have any information either. They knock you down. So you learn, don't ask questions. You don't need anything. You don't need anything. No, I need a lot. I need a lot. I need love. I need kindness. I need tenderness. I need affection. I need intimacy. I need truth. I need honesty. I need good food. I need good exercise. I need help with emotional situations I can't do. I need tons of stuff. I need tons of stuff. And as I get these things, I change. I become the one thing I fear the most all my life is a gentle person. I have an animal at home waiting for me to come home. Now my image is, you know, I'd like to tell you I have two Dobermans and four Rottweilers chained up, you know, eating my neighbors for something to do while I'm gone. I have a cat. You know, just got him in a recent custody battle. Now, he's not even a goddamn fruitcake because her daughter had given him drugs, but, you know, we love each other. He's not. He reminds me a lot of myself, you know. Sometimes you go to reach for him to pet him, and he sees what he sees is not your hand coming. He sees an incoming flight of flying saucers, you know. And he gets really weirded out, you know, like. And it reminds me of me, you know. People used to reach for me to love me, and I didn't know what was coming. And I get weirded out. And I couldn't have relationships because I did not feel anything. You can't have a relationship with somebody who doesn't feel anything. But, you know, I sat in a meeting 17 years sober, listened to people talk about having their feelings hurt. I didn't know what they meant. I had no idea what it meant. I wouldn't let you get that close. I had no idea. It hurt my feelings. Now, boy, I get wiped out easy. But I love it. I love it. I don't want to change any of this. I don't want to go back to being a non-person. I want to be alive. You know, I've come to this conclusion. My feelings are who I am. That's how important they are. It's who I am. If I'm not my feelings, what am I? Now, okay, for the metaphysical geniuses here, I am not taking it the one step above race consciousness into, okay, let's leave that one for a little while. Get back down to where we have to function on a daily basis. We'll get to that one later. If I am not what I feel, who am I? I can't be my job. That can be gone tomorrow. I'm certainly not my personality. I can change that from room to room at a party. You know. That's not who I am. You know, I'm not my car. My car can be taken away. Can't be my house. Can be burned down by the time I return home. If it's gone, then I'm gone. There's no more me, but it can be gone, and I'm still going to be here. You know, my job can be gone. I'm still going to be here. My car, I'm not, my clothes, I'm not. And don't get hard on yourself, man, because we live in a society that creates the image that you are what you hang on the outside. You know, you are what you hang on the outside. I'm so delighted to be living in New Mexico now instead of Southern California. So glad to be out of that, man. It's lunacy. You know, where the first impression, you know, it's got to be what you pull up in or, you know, how you look when you walk through the door or, you know, if you don't make it on that first 3 seconds, you're nobody. You know, I don't want to live like that anymore. I'm glad to, I got to find out what I feel. What I feel, isn't always great. Gee, sometimes I'm really sad. But I'm a really good person today. I'll give you a little story. Because I think in recovery, we got to become responsible. Responsible. I saw an airplane flying home not long ago. It made a stop in Phoenix and then went on from L.A. to Phoenix to Albuquerque, where I live. And that was going on to Tulsa. I love kids today. Because I'm in touch with my child. I've met my child. Great kid, man. Beautiful, charming, wonderful. Doesn't trust me, but, you know, beautiful kid lives inside of me. You know, he does today. I mean, I have a beautiful relationship today with myself. I got to have that one first. Can't have another one, you know, until I have that. Oh, I hated hearing that. You know, when you're going to a meeting and you haven't been late in 3 months, you're crazy, and all you need is some son of a bitch getting up saying you can't have a relationship with somebody else, so you have one with yourself. Like, oh, come on. You know, if I get in a relationship, everything will be okay. No, well, it's going to be a repeat of everything that went before. I'm going to sing the same songs and do the same dances I've done with every relationship all my life, and when I run out of material, I leave. And the only reason I leave when I run out of material is because then you look to me to give you something, and I don't have anything to give you, and you're pointing up to me that something's wrong with me, and I'm not enough, and I got to get out. I gotta get away. I don't know how to have a relationship. I have no idea how to have a relationship. None. So I've got this kid, see, inside of me. Well, I love this kid. The more I get in touch with this kid, the more I get like a kid myself. And I meet kids today on airplanes and stuff like that. They love me. Because you've never seen a kid this big. You know. They keep thinking I should be a mature, gray-headed, 51-year-old adult male. Like, ah! You know, I get in it with them on the airplane. You know. You know, we just have a great time across the aisle, the seats and stuff. I'll share a little story. I don't know why I'm going to share it, but I'm going to share it. One of the things that might want to... Wow, this is really interesting where this talk's going. Well, what the hell? This is embarrassing. Well, here we go. It's the only way I get free, man. One of the things I had feared all of my life... I'm going to tell you how important it is in my life to go back and discover this stuff and get rid of it. Experience it, feel it, get rid of it, and go on. It says in the promises, we shall not wish to shut the door on the past, man. Too much door closing on the past goes on around here. It's time to blow that sucker open and get cooking, you know. All of my life, all of my life I've been afraid of the anger of women. Not the anger of men. Because I'm a certified homicidal social psychopath. And by the way, I've never been released except on legal technicalities. I've never gotten a clean bill of health. I remember one vocational rehab wanted to make me into a social worker. I said, you gotta be fucking kidding, you know. You're not reading the paperwork. You're missing a real important point here. I don't like people. But when it came to women, terrified of the anger of women. So when I'm beginning a relationship, I'm not going to do anything I think is going to make you mad. So I went immediately into this crap, as she says to me, well, let's go to a movie. Would you like to go to a movie? Yeah. And she says, what movie would you like to see? Well, now, there's a movie I really want to see. You know, I want to go see Apocalypse Now. Oh, I don't know. What movie would you like to see? She said, I don't know. What movie would you like to see? I said, no, I don't really care. You pick. She said, I'd like to go see April in Paris. Well, I don't want to see fucking April in Paris. I don't even like Gene Kelly. You know, I mean, God, I don't want to see it. But we go see April in Paris. Because I'm not going to say anything. Because I don't want to make her mad. But I hate her. I hate her. I hate the goddamn movie. I hate the drive to the movie. And when I'm in that place, then nothing goes right. The line's long. You wind up in the second row from the front. The popcorn's cold. You can't find a goddamn parking place. There's a ticket on your car. You can come out. You know, it's like, it all goes right in the toilet when I'm in that place, man. You know, the minute I start selling me out, it's like there's a, it's like there's just some force out there that says, come on to me.
I'm going to beat you to death. This will be a night you're going to remember for a long time when it's over.
So I can never cope with the anger of women. That didn't change. I'd say something to my sponsor, and you know, I'd like to tell her about this, but it just makes me real uncomfortable. Turn her over to God, it'll work out. I quit smoking, that helped it. I got a few words off the first few weeks I quit smoking. Which, by the way, at some point you're recovering. But we won't go into that. Go ahead, drive the goddamn nails, I don't care. Anyhow, oh, you may have made me, no. So, this problem has not gone away. This problem has not gone away. So, a few months ago, I'm on an airplane flying home, and this little guy sitting next to me is about 8 years old, and I say, hi, and he says, hi, and he sees this big kid sitting next to him. And he says, can I put my head in your lap? I said, yeah, great, sure. I get a pillow, and he puts his head in my lap, and he's got his little name tag on, you know, he's going home from California. And after a little while, he sits up, and he said something, I don't remember what, and I said, would you like a bear to hold for the flight? He says, oh, yeah, so, you know, the last thing I think he expects is an adult like me to reach in his shoulder bag and bring out a teddy bear. But... You see, my inner child likes bears, so there are bears everywhere I go. There's one sitting back in a room with a lambskin vest on, a mountain hat, a red kerchief, waiting to take me home to Santa Fe. Because my kid likes bears. If I take bears with me when I travel, my kid's happy. My kid's happy, then it's, you know, the trip goes smoother. If I deny the child, anyway. I give him the bear, and then he says, you know, my dog died. He says, my dog died. And I said, oh, that's sad. I said, that's a very terrible thing. He said, yeah. He said, I'm really mad at my dad, you know. I'm really mad at my dad because my dog died. And I said, well, I don't think, why is that? And he said, my dad let the dog out, you know, and he knew the dog would run in the street and get killed. And he did it intentionally, you know. And I said, I don't think, no, he said, my dad let the dog out. The dog killed. I said, I don't think you let him intentionally let your dog out to get killed. He says, oh, yeah, he did. He says, yeah, I know I did. He says, you know, my dad's not a nice guy, man. You know, he says, he hits me. You know, he says, he hits me here, and he hits me here, and he hits me here. He says, hey, it's my mom, too. You know, he says, nobody's going to hit my mom, you know. Nobody's going to hurt my mom. He says, I'm coming from my grandpa's. You know, my grandpa's going to come home in about 2 weeks, and he's going to, you know, take care of it. And we're not going to do this anymore, because he's not a nice guy. There's something inside of me, man, just died, you know, when I heard this from this little guy. So this is between the trip from Phoenix to Albuquerque. So I thought, well, Robert, you're now a member of the world, you know, and you got a responsibility. So when I got off the plane in Albuquerque, I went into the airport police in Albuquerque, and I said, okay, we've got a situation that needs to be dealt with. Well, if a child on the plane is being beaten home, somebody's got to deal with it. And I was about as interested, you know, as man on the moon. So I said, okay, I'll tell you what I said. But anyway, I try and be recovered most of the time, but occasionally... An uncooperative person in a uniform, now that I'm a clean, upstanding citizen, does not bring out the best in me. So I went to the phone, I called Oklahoma, where this kid was going, Tulsa, Oklahoma. I got the police in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I got one precinct, and they said, they didn't know, they couldn't do anything about it, but they connected me with their precinct at the airport. I got a cop on the phone with the precinct at the airport, and I told him what was going on. He says, okay, great. He says, we'll deal with it. Nice guy, you know. He said, we'll see that there's an officer gets on the plane before the boy gets off.
well, whoever's going to meet him, whatever one of his parents is going to meet him. I said, I think it's his mother because her name was on the tag. He said, and we'll talk to him before he gets off the plane. And I sat in the phone booth and I broke down. I sobbed and I just, oh God, I just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed because I could picture myself as this little boy sitting in his little seat on this plane going home to all this fear and all this problem and having this big cop get on the plane and say, can I help you? Can I help you? Somebody cared enough, you know, to see if I could help you. And I went on home, and I was in the middle of a separation at the time, and the woman called me on the phone like 2 days later and just went off. We had worked months on having a peaceful, adult, rational, mature separation. And in one phone call, I went all right straight down the toilet. I got this screaming woman on the other end of the phone, and I go into a panic, complete panic. The next 2 days, I'm nuts. I'm walking around Santa Fe, New Mexico, one of the beautiful places in the world, and I can't see anything. I can function mechanically. I'm not talking about paralyzed physically. I'm talking about paralyzed emotionally. I can still go to the cleaners and get my cleaning and take it and go to the restaurant and get myself fed. I can do all that stuff today. I don't get paralyzed at that point anymore. But I was paralyzed emotionally. So finally I called my therapist on the phone in Los Angeles and said, I can't afford it, but I got to get on a plane and come see you now because this woman's gone off the goddamn deep end. I'm totally insane and it has nothing to do with her. I said, I know it's got nothing to do with her. So to make a long story real short, I jumped on a plane, flew in, and she's been waiting for this one for a long time. Amazing how patient they are. I sat down and we began to go over what, you know, we went back. We went back to find out what happened. And what we found out in essence happened is from the age of about 1.5 to the age of about 5, my mother had beaten me senseless on countless, countless times. And it stopped at age 5. And I know why it stopped. We figured out why it stopped because I had to go to school. I missed so much of my first year of school, they didn't give me a grade. When I asked my mother about it a couple of years ago, not knowing what had gone on, I said, how come I missed so much school, they wouldn't give me a grade? She says, I don't know. And she, maybe she doesn't. Maybe she doesn't, though. Maybe she doesn't even remember. Maybe her pain is so great, she doesn't even remember. But you see, what was explained to me finally is, you see, I don't have the capacity, or did not have the capacity, to distinguish between someone expressing anger and a real threat. A real, honest-to-God threat. So I could not allow the anger, because when you get mad, then I want to kill you. See, and I don't want to deal with that. So then people say this stuff isn't important. Man, I've been banging my brains out here for 24 years trying to have a relationship with another human being. Just trying to goddamn love somebody and let somebody love me in return. Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. Only because I wasn't trying, obviously, you know. I had not gone into a monastery anywhere. I couldn't do it. I didn't have the information. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I didn't know. Now I got the information. I'm excited. Possibilities are endless. It's conceivable marriage number 6 is not far down the line. I have no idea who to. You know, I mean, there's no one right here, but hey. Goddamn, I've been unleashed with new information, you know. Yeah. What I'm trying to say to you is this. There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. And you are enough. That's what I'm trying to say to you. I used to have to look everywhere else in the world for stuff. No, I don't have to anymore. You want to see God today? Look in my eyes. You want to see self-respect today? Look in my eyes. I don't have to look in yours. Look in mine. You want to see dignity? Responsibility? You want to see somebody home? Look in my eyes. There's somebody who lives here now. I go home alone, me and the cat. You know, cat don't talk. It's okay. I look in the mirror today, there's somebody there. A whole person. Well, almost. There's a few pieces missing still. But see, it doesn't matter now that there are pieces missing because I've given myself permission to get the information that I need to put the rest of the pieces together. And this talk, no matter how you may perceive it, is not a bad rap on AA. AA does what it's meant to do. It has never, ever professed to do it all. And if you're out there seeking, looking for more stuff, if you encounter anybody that tells you their way is the only way, run like a son of a bitch. And make sure you still have your wallet while you're going, too. So all I'm trying to do, you know, is give you permission and give me permission to get the necessary tools you may or may not need. This whole talk may be absolutely irrelevant to some of the people sitting in this room. You may be sitting there saying, what the hell is he talking about? You know, Jesus, where did they get this guy from? Well, they got me from New Mexico, actually, but it may have no importance to you. It may have no meaning in your life. But if it does, all I'm trying to say is you're not wrong. There's nothing wrong with you. You are enough. You just don't have the information you need to fix it. You want to hear the whole problem summed up, the best I ever heard it summed up in my life? I was with a girl on the program who was having her first birthday. And her mother, who had 4 years on the program, called her on the phone. She didn't have any money. Her mother said, look, I don't have any money to buy you a present, so I'll tell you what I'm going to do. She said, this is the best I can do for your birthday. She says, I want you to understand something. She says, I want you to know and understand that I know, I, your mother, am responsible for most of the problems you have in your life today. I'm responsible that you can't have a good relationship. I'm responsible that you're a rotten mother. I'm responsible that you don't know how to hold a job. I'm responsible that you don't know how to go about the business of living. I am responsible. She said, but for your sake, on this your first birthday, understand, you're responsible for the solution. Wow! I like that a lot! I can handle that. Okay, I'm screwed up, but I didn't know it. But I gotta fix it. As long as I understand that I didn't do it, I can get out there and start fixing it. But when I think I'm fully responsible for the way I am, I go into a shell. I won't go out there. I won't let you know. I hide. Now I go out there and say, I gotta fix this. I gotta, you know, work, you know, can you fix it? Whatever it may be, you know, I want to get it fixed now. See? That's the only message I'm trying to carry here. If you need additional tools, don't be afraid of them. There's a study done in why you'll love this one. There was a study done not too long ago in Washington State in which they wanted to find out why people in a few years of sobriety went back to drinking. You know what the answer they came up with? Poor nutrition. They said people continue to eat garbage, continue to stay depressed. If you stay depressed long enough, you will go back to the only solution to end that depression that you know. I don't know if they're right or wrong. I know that if I eat something not good for me, like I'm a vegetarian today, and, you know, I live my life's pretty clean, you know. But if I eat something that's not good for me, I wake up the next morning, I'm afraid. I wake up afraid. There's nothing to do with anything that's happened. It has to do with what I put in my body, you know.
There's a lot of stuff going on, you know. People come to me, I swear to God, if Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob sat down right this minute in this room, this moment, and the first 100 and founded AA today, brand new today, therapy, nutrition, and exercise would be integral parts of this program. They got a hold of everything there was to get a hold of when they were out there putting it together. They didn't miss a lick. And like Brad was saying, I heard the part about it. They sent the fifth chapter to Dr. Tebow, a psychiatrist, not an alcoholic, and he made suggestions, and they made those changes. They made those changes. He went outside. He knew. He understood. So I'm just here to tell you, man, that after you know, it's kind of like this for me. Once I was no longer fighting the substance, and once I was no longer fighting the alcoholic personality, then I've been told, you'll love this, guys. This one is a real winner.
that the alcoholic who sobers up will eventually, in the first couple of years of recovery, once they're no longer drinking, flip and begin to behave like the non-alcoholic or co-alcoholic or codependent mother as opposed to the alcoholic father.
Oh, God! No! Not like her! No!
But it's true. It's true. Oh, God, I look in the mirror, and there's my mother. I go, oh, no. Oh, it's time to quit. What? I know the stuff, some of this stuff is uncomfortable, you know. It's meant to be, because I don't know about you, but I don't do anything when I'm comfortable. But what I guess it is this, you know, you work the steps, you get sober, you get clean, you get moving down the path, and then you may hit a wall, you may hit a place where you're just stuck, man, you start to die in that place. And all I'm trying to say is don't be afraid at that point to pick up another tool. See, I'm convinced that once you're sober, once you work the steps, you know, to the best of your ability, like at least one time, once you've sponsored a few people, you've been active a little bit in AA, you've just reached the starting line. You ain't at the end. This ain't the end here. This is the beginning here. This is where it starts. This isn't the end of nothing. It all starts now. It starts now. And God bless you, and, you know, may hold you gently in the palm of his hand while you're on your journey. It's a good one. Thank you.